Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Robin Young, it's Here and Now. The Justice Department has begun an investigation into the leak of classified information about President Bush's secret domestic spying program. We'll have more on that story's political fallout coming up later in the show. But first, although the number of U.S. troops in Iraq is projected to decline starting next year, the Bush administration is expected to approve a new policy that significantly increases the number of American advisors who monitor Iraqi police. This new policy comes amid accounts of torture and murder of Sunni Arabs by Iraqi special police forces. We're joined on the line by Pam Hess. She's Pentagon reporter for United Press International. Pam, what does this policy mean? How many more U.S. advisors or mentors are we talking about here and why?
It's several hundred. I don't think a firm number has been put on it. To put it into perspective, it's not a large increase in the number of troops that we have in Iraq, but it is a large increase in the number of troops that we have embedded with special police battalions and public order battalions. Mm-hmm. And why is after last month when they found that Ministry of Interior secret jail with 170 prisoners, some of whom showed signs of abuse, U.S. intelligence went through other reports that they have gotten to take a second look at them and see if maybe they had been tipped off to some other places that they hadn't followed up on because they hadn't been looking for it. So they've gone back in. I think they've found at least three other places now, and that has spurred them on to doing a sharper oversight of what's going on with special police. Could have something to do with the fact that General Peter Pace, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, earlier in December made it very clear what the U.S. military's responsibilities are in Iraq, which is to prevent inhumane treatment where and when they see it. And these actions came on the heels of that. I think that was really clarifying the policy and giving the military its marching orders, which is you are responsible for this and you need to look out.
First, could you briefly just tell me, though, this special police force, what is it? Who's in charge of it? What does it do?
Special police forces were begun actually a couple of years ago. They are connected not to the Ministry of Defense, which is where the U.S. military has put most of its emphasis. Instead, it's connected to the Ministry of the Interior. The Ministry of the Interior is led by a Shiite who's closely related to the party that is related to one of the militias in Iraq that's a Shiite militia called the Badr Brigade. The Shiites have been on the receiving end for so long of Sunni brutality because Saddam Hussein was a Sunni and most of his security forces were Sunnis, that it's unclear whether or not this is politically motivated, militia motivated, or an organic welling up of retribution for so many years of brutality.
I'm also wondering, with the U.S. having its own prison abuse scandal, what about credibility here?
What I found when I was in Iraq is that Iraqis wanted to be in U.S. jails, not in Iraqi jails. They got three square meals a day, time to pray. I toured a couple of the jails, the smaller ones that were on bases, and they were clean and well-lit, and the people were taken care of. There were their rights posted on the walls. I think since Abu Ghraib, the U.S. has been pretty careful about making sure that its prison system, the detention system, was on the up and up. Mm-hmm. And Iraqis seem to know that. This Iraqi Interior Ministry issue has been going on for quite a while. Last year, when the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment arrived in Tal Afar, they found in the basement of the town hall where the police were stationed, which was an entirely Shiite force in a city that was mixed Shiite and Sunni, they found, I think, 26 prisoners who were being starved and abused. They freed them, and they have the United States has helped begin legal action to be taken against these police.
I'm wondering, with this increased mentoring of the Iraqi special police, and also the U.S. saying this week that it's going to delay handing over American-run prisons to Iraqis, I also read the U.S. ambassador saying 2006 will be the year of the police in Iraq. What does all of this mean in terms of U.S. strategy? Is this major, Pam?
The year of the police in Iraq was actually something that was announced well before any of this happened. For the first 2.5 years, they've been focusing entirely on getting the Iraqi military up and going so that the military could take on the insurgency. But in an insurgency, you have to shift the locus of control and authority from the military to the police because that makes the insurgents into criminals as opposed to a legitimate opposition force. So this has always been the plan, which is to start with the Iraqi military and then move into the police. The fact that we're not handing over jails and that we're focusing on this more is now recognition of what the U.S. responsibility in there is. As you know, Colin Powell famously said, you broke it, you bought it. We broke Iraq, and we are responsible under the Geneva Conventions for ensuring justice and humane treatment for as long as we are there.
Well, thanks very much, Pam.
Thank you.
Pam Hess is Pentagon reporter for United Press International. At the start of the new year this Sunday, millions of the nation's elderly will have new prescription drug coverage under changes in the federal health care program known as Medicare Part D. It's the largest overhaul to the Medicare program in 40 years, and it could affect some 42 million Americans. There's been widespread confusion over the new coverage, particularly for those who are both elderly and low income, people known as dual eligibles because they receive both Medicare and Medicaid. There are questions about whether their prescription drugs that were fully covered under Medicaid will still be covered and whether they'll even have access to their medication. We're joined on the line by Tracy Murray. She's an administrator at the Cedar Crest Nursing Home and Rehabilitation Center in Sunnyvale, California. Tracy, what has it been like to prepare for these changes?
It has been absolutely crazy for both our residents and their family members trying to figure out what is the right plan for them. We're just trying to help them to wade through this because it seems the only way to get the correct information, at least the correct information for the moment, is through the Medicare website. And most people who are having to go through this change on the 1st of January don't have access to computers.
So basically what happens here is a lot of these folks automatically get entered into new health plans, and that's what changes their health coverage. Can you explain the intent of the program and how many people we're talking about and what happens here?
Well, I know that the government tried to do something to make it a better health care system and make it so more people would have coverage. However, I don't think that everybody's going to have the coverage that they think that the government thinks that they're going to achieve by making this change. The people who are dual eligible or eligible for Medicaid and Medicare were automatically enrolled. The programs they're enrolled in are not necessarily the best programs for them. And the rest of the people who are a private payer in HMO status have until May 15th to make a final decision.
You also had a problem with even knowing which health plans folks had been switched to. Is that correct? You had a problem finding out the information about which plans people will be covered under starting Sunday.
We had a huge problem. Most families didn't understand what this new program was, why they were doing it, why were they getting all this information. Because they not only got the information they were sent by the PDP that they had been auto-enrolled in, but they got this slew of information from other vendors who were trying to get their business. We've run family council meetings where we've brought in a pharmacy, we've brought in business office managers, the ombudsman, everyone we can. Families still didn't understand what had to be done. So the confusion out there, it's caused this huge amount of anxiety, and people didn't know what was going on, so it's a huge education process.
PDP is prescription drug plan?
The PDP is the prescription drug plan. Those are who have signed up to provide the programs through the Medicare D program, and there's hundreds of them. So they've automatically been enrolled in any one of, say 400 different programs, and there's no way to know unless you go on and they provide formularies. But unless you're pretty savvy about figuring out formularies, which most of our people aren't, and they don't know how to read through this. I mean, it's huge volumes of information that they send out to everybody who's eligible for Medicare D, and there's just no way to sift through it. If you call on the 800 number, you're lucky if you get through, and if you do, they just tell you to talk to your doctor or talk to your pharmacist, and doctors and pharmacists aren't supposed to point you in any directions. We're not supposed to either. What I've done is I and some of my staff members have become familiar with the Medicare website. We've gone in and entered for people their list of medications, and it will pop out a list of the different PDPs who would be best for that person. It also tells you the worst. So you can enter in your list of medications. It's cumbersome. If you're not computer savvy, it's awkward and it can take quite a long time, but it will pop out an answer for you. On one list of medications that I did for one of my resident family members, it was $217 a month for their list of 8 medications. On the opposite end of the scale, it was $6,700, and this is an annual amount. But that's for the same list of medication.
I'm also wondering, I read a statistic indicating that more than 70% of the folks in nursing homes have some form of dementia. How do these folks, how are they able to wade through all of these new regulations? And aren't you restricted from being able to assist them in making this choice?
We can't tell them which one to pick, and we can't tell them, I can't do anything as a judgment standpoint. I can, however, do exactly what we have done, and that's I go right up to the line. I enter in all their medications, and that will, you know, let me know which programs are the most beneficial. That's from the Medicare website, and that's what Medicare is saying are the best plans for them. I am merely doing the legwork for them and entering their list of medications in for them.
Mm-hmm.
Then it pops out the answer, and they can choose from the, you can compare up to 3. At a time. And so we just print that right out for them. We show them, here are what Medicare says are the best plans for you. When they're in a nursing home, we say, you know, we take it one step further and say, these are who our pharmacy is already contracted with. They can choose a pharmacy or to go with a PDP that's not contracted with our pharmacy, but that means they're going to have to go and pick it up and deliver it, which most people don't want to do that. I mean, it's just such a huge, massive confusion, and it's caused so much anxiety for our residents, for their family members. Some of them are also eligible for Medicare, and they can't figure it out either. So we're helping several generations to try and figure out this mess.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that a lot of pharmacists are very reluctant to doing what we're doing because they don't want to cross the line and they don't want to be construed as trying to influence people.
Are there also health issues as well? If this happens on Sunday and then there's resulting confusion and the access issues to medication, are there those questions that need to be ironed out quickly?
I think most of the pharmacies, at least for nursing homes, are taking a very proactive approach and they are delivering medications regardless of coverage through this transition. You know, and I know that nursing homes do bear a part of that responsibility and that cost, but we would rather make sure that our residents have the medications that they need, and, you know, we'll figure out the money later.
We're talking with Tracy Murray. She's an administrator at the Cedar Crest Nursing Home and Rehabilitation Center in Sunnyvale, California. We'll continue our conversation after a break. Also, we speak with a Cedar Crest resident about the difficulties she and her family have had navigating this new Medicare Part D system. Her son is an accountant, and it took him days to figure it out. Coming up later in the show, the year in politics. 2005 began with promises of reforming Social Security. What happened? There's more coming up here and now. We've been talking about the new Medicare prescription drug benefit, which goes into effect on Sunday. Low-income elderly on both Medicaid and Medicare will automatically be shifted into new prescription drug plans. The White House says this new policy will reduce costs and improve choice, but what's the view from those who either are elderly or those who work with the people who will be affected? Well, we've been talking with Tracy Murray. She's an administrator at the Cedar Crest Nursing and Rehabilitation Center in Sunnyvale, California. Ms. Murray, you've told us about the education campaign that you've undertaken to try to help residents of your facility understand these complex changes that go into effect on Sunday. And you said there's massive confusion over the new plans, and some pharmacies are just delivering necessary medicine and they're going to figure out the money later. Is there a danger, though, that 2 days from now people may not be able to get their prescription drugs?
Well, I think in nursing homes, fortunately, we do have a safety net because we always have our emergency kits. that have a very limited amount. But we have our pharmacies are standing. I mean, everybody's geared up for the weekend just to make sure that the transition is smooth. We've also taken precautions. We've ordered medications in advance, and I think that would be that's the advice that I've given to everybody I know who is not in a nursing home, is to make sure you have your medications so you're not having to order them the first of the month. Because that's when the most confusion is going to be, is in the first few days. Once we make it past that, people will be figuring it out, and then it'll be a matter of billing. And I think most, unless it's a very expensive medication, the pharmacies are going to be filling and then figuring out.
The White House has said that this Medicare Part D program really is supposed to improve choice and reduce costs. Do you think that it will fulfill those goals?
I think that's possible. In the future, that may happen. Initially, that's not going to be the case. People are just too confused. They're not going to choose the right programs to enroll in because they don't have the correct information and they don't know how to get it. Most of the people, if they don't have help from a family member or somebody close who can get into the computer and run their medication list for them, that truly is the only way to figure it out. So although I'm not trying to contradict the White House, who obviously has greater knowledge than I do, I think it's going to be a matter of a lot of time before we get to the point where it's actually going to save anybody money.
Tracy Murray is an administrator at the Cedar Crest Nursing Home and Rehabilitation Center in Northern California. We're joined now by one of the residents at that nursing home. Kathleen Wade is 63 years old. She is what's known as dual eligible, meaning that her health costs are paid for by both Medicaid and Medicare. But her husband's are not. He is not on Medicaid, but like millions of senior citizens, he too is trying to figure out the best Medicare drug plan for himself. Hello, Mrs. Wade.
Hello.
I'm wondering, you are at the Cedar Crest Nursing Home, and
yes,
you are a Medicaid recipient.
Yes.
Do you have your health plan figured out and the changes that will take effect on Sunday?
Yes. We are very, very lucky. We got all the booklets and everything in the mail. My husband and I went through them, and we sat there and looked at each other like, what the heck is this? On top of the booklet, we've gotten enough advertisement that it totally confuses you. We are very lucky in the sense that my son is a CPA. He took everything home. He got on the computer. It took him a few days, but he got everything figured out for both of us. He was amazed. He said, I cannot understand how they can make something so complicated for the elderly, a lot of whom have nobody to sit down and read this and figure it out for them. And he felt really, really bad about it because he says somebody's going to get taken one way or the other because they don't know what they're doing. So it's a very, very complicated process. And as Tracy said, you have to have somebody in the family or a very, very close friend that really knows what they're doing, is very, very computer savvy in order to figure this out and help you with it.
Do you know people there who probably don't have that and will not have those kinds of resources to be able to figure this out?
Well, there's a lot of people that I've met here, and, you know, I don't know them personally, but just to look at them, I'd say, this one's not going to understand it. That one's not going to understand it. Because some people, you know, you get to a certain age, and some people just do not understand anything. And they have to sit there, and they have to take the advice and the help from somebody else that's willing to do it for them. And it's a very frightening thing, because you have now lost control. Somebody else has the control, and it's up to them to make sure that you're going to be okay. And that's scary.
Right.
That's really scary.
What's the biggest change that you'll see come Sunday? How is your plan changing and your prescription drug coverage changing?
Oh, boy. Mine is not going to change that much. My husband, on the other hand, is going to see a huge amount. Right now, he is doing co-payments. As of Sunday, that is going to change. We will be paying full price for his medicine for the first, I think, 6 months, and after that, it will be 80%.
Tell me what that means in terms of dollars. Co-pay is how much and full price is how much?
His co-pays run anywhere from $4 to $20. Now, for the first 6 months, we will go in and we will have to pay full price for his medicines. Come June, then the Plan D will pick up 80% and we will pick up the rest. I'm not really happy with it, but my son has figured out that in the end, by the end of next year, it will save us at least a couple of thousand dollars, $2,000 to $3,000. But it's going to be hard having a large amount coming out of our pocket.
So overall, if the intent here is to reduce costs for people, do you think that that will eventually happen? It's just sort of getting through this initial confusing transition period?
Personally speaking, no, I don't think that will eventually happen. When it comes to reducing costs, I think, for pharmacy items, I don't think it's going to happen. I really don't. I see every year it going up and it going up and it going up. And I think it's just a matter of catch up. Eventually, it's going to, you know, it's going to skyrocket. It almost has to.
Well, Mrs. Wade, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Kathleen Wade is a resident at the Cedar Crest Nursing Home and Rehabilitation Center in Sunnyvale, California. Next week on Here and Now, as the cost of healthcare climbs, should doctors consider the price of expensive medical procedures before they're done? One policy analyst says it's time to put emotions aside, or healthcare costs will strangle economic growth. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from
Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, the Justice Department said it has begun an investigation into who leaked classified information to the New York Times about President Bush's secret domestic spying program. The tough response to the leak comes after a difficult year for the Bush administration. Remember, just over a year ago, 2 days after he was reelected, an energized President Bush told reporters he had secured some political capital that he was going to use.
I've earned capital in this election, and I'm going to spend it for what I told the people I'd spend it on, which is, you've heard the agenda, Social Security and tax reform, moving this economy forward, education, fighting and winning the war on terror.
But following the leadership failures from Hurricane Katrina, the indictment of a top White House aide, the withdrawal of a Supreme Court nominee, the growing death toll in Iraq, and the public disapproval of the war, President Bush may not have much political capital left. For their perspectives on the year that was, we turn now to some veteran political observers. From Washington, Martha Kumar joins us. She's professor of political science at Towson University in Maryland. Hello, Martha.
Good morning.
Good afternoon. Also with us is John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Hi, John.
Hey, Deborah. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And from Iowa, David Yepsen, political columnist for the Des Moines Register. Hello, David.
Good to be with you.
John, let's go to you first. I've heard this described as the rockiest year of the Bush presidency. How would you describe it?
Well, there's no question it was the rockiest year of the Bush presidency. We saw a president, as your setup piece indicated, who emerged from the election, stronger majorities in the House and Senate, committed to advancing his domestic agenda. In particular, he mentioned in that clip Social Security and tax reform. Both of those priorities now appear to be shelved for the indefinite future because Republicans on Capitol Hill simply aren't willing to go along with the administration. The president has seen Terri Schiavo, Hurricane Katrina, the failed Harriet Myers nomination to the Supreme Court. All of those things take a real toll on his popularity, and when that happens, members of your own party lose the sense of cohesion and discipline. He has ended the year on an up note, and the question is, can he preserve that momentum into January with the confirmation of Sam Alito to the Supreme Court and some other favorable developments?
David, what about you here? I'm just thinking, if we look at some of the successes as well, and there have been some new laws on bankruptcy and class action lawsuits, the confirmation of Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. How about weighing the pluses against the minuses here? What would you say?
I think the minuses far outweigh any pluses. Many of those things, bankruptcy reform, they have little relevance to the average American. What's important are things like Katrina, a war in Iraq that is has not been going well. And as John and everyone's noted here, the president's job approval ratings are down. And I think one of the stories of 2005 is how energized Democrats have become. If you look back to where we were a year ago, Democrats were sort of down and out and wondering what hit them and how could they lose this election. And now I think the tables are turned. Republicans are the ones who are scrambling to save themselves in the 06 election and Democrats are feeling much better about their prospects.
Martha, your thoughts here? I know that the president's numbers may be down a bit, but they're inching up toward the end of the year. Is he doing something now that he wasn't doing before? Is the strategy working?
One of the things that he's been doing is at the end here of the year is explaining his Iraq policy and admitting to mistakes, which is something that he had not done before, or saying that things have not gone well and they've had to readjust. That one of the characteristics, I think, of his presidency is that he believes in taking strong action and then announcing policy. But beyond that, he doesn't like to go into how he got to the decisions that he did. What was the process? What alternatives did he discuss? When he is questioned about a policy after he has said what he's wanted to say about it, he gets short with those asking questions, as you can see in presidential press conferences, where he will often get short because he doesn't like to go into that. And he says that just people are interested in process. But people really want to know why. Why did he do what he did? But I think that Katrina was particularly disastrous for him because it went to the heart of what his strengths were. In his reelection, people did not vote for him because they agreed with all of his policy positions, but rather because they thought he was a strong leader and that he had very good management skills. And both of those became called into question because he did not take a strong leadership role. It took him several days to recognize the degree of the crisis when the public itself understood its dimensions. And then his management skills, and particularly all of the money that had been spent on Homeland Security, couldn't be brought together to work on a hurricane. That those were problems that I think have been particularly important that are difficult for him to get through. But much of what you see here are second-term problems of presidents, that the Congress gets restless, that scandals arise, as we had with the Abramoff scandal, which has claimed a couple of victims in the executive branch, and the Valerie Plame scandal, which has caught up the White House. And all of that takes time away from his discussing his agenda. But even when he has been out discussing his agenda, as he did with Social Security, that you found that the approval for his handling of Social Security in February was 44%. But after he had gone on his campaign of 60 cities in 60 days, by July it had fallen to 29%.
Right. John, I'm wondering, are these second-term problems here when we hear about these things, we see the approval ratings dropping, when we hear about the secret domestic spying program and this investigation, secret CIA prisons that the Washington Post reported on recently, these covert anti-terrorism efforts amid some of the leadership problems as well. Aren't these unusual, or do they just seem that way because they're very timely right now?
Well, there is a pattern of presidents in their second terms having difficulty either because they get arrogant or they overreach. And they get slapped back by Congress and the American people. Part of this is idiosyncratic to Bush as an unambiguously conservative Republican leader who is pushing the envelope in terms of what's politically acceptable in things like the Social Security plan. And part of it is, you mentioned the spying and the detainee policy, that sort of thing. Some of those are sort of unique circumstances to the unusual war on terror that we're in right now. I did want to mention one other thing that the president is doing right as we close the end of the year, and that is sitting in his chair in the Oval Office and watching energy prices come down. He didn't have a whole lot to do with them going up in 2005, but he paid a big price when they did. It made people anxious and unhappy, and people are feeling somewhat better now that they're coming down. And if the president can see that trend continue, that's going to help him and his party in 06.
So there's a bit of a plus side here, at least.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to the extent that was an irritant, energy prices were getting in the way of the president's getting some credit from the strong overall performance of the economy. It's not the only thing getting in the way. Wages have not grown, especially for blue-collar workers, as fast as income has grown for people at the top of the scale. But that phenomenon combined with energy prices really kept people from seeing the fact that we had an economy growing at 4%.
Okay, hold that thought 1 minute, John, okay? You're listening to Here and Now. Okay, John, back to you. There are some pluses here that you were talking about. Can you explain a little bit more?
Well, 4% economic growth is not too bad when you look in the context of the rest of the world. Now, some are starting to worry that we'll see a slowdown in 2006. If that happened, you know, we talked a lot in 05 about a perfect storm facing the president when you combined problems in Iraq, problems with Social Security, overreach on Schiavo, Katrina, the bungled Myers nomination. How could it get worse? I'll tell you one way it could get worse is if we go into a recession in the latter part of 2006 as Republicans get ready to face the voters, Republican incumbents, that is, in the House and Senate. That would be a calamity. But right now the economy's purring along fairly substantially.
Okay, David, I'd like to ask you about reaction from sort of middle America and the heartland here. How does it look outside of the Beltway, do you think, some of these things? How are they playing out?
Well, I don't think the average voter feels as upbeat as some of these economic numbers would indicate. And some of them, frankly, there are causes for concerns in terms of yield curve and things like that, which are very abstract to people. But in terms of where people live...
You don't think, David, they're talking about the yield curve in the coffee shops in Dubuque?
I don't think they are, but I think that is a bad omen. I'll leave it to the Wall Street Journal to explain. In the real world, gasoline prices are still too high. People are still worried, are very worried about their health insurance. They're concerned about the quality of their schools, their job security, which is why in our polling of Iowa voters, you'll find well over a majority of them think the country is headed in the wrong direction. So some of these microscopic upticks here that we've seen in the president's fortunes, I don't think have materialized on the street, and I think Republicans are very nervous. Where I'm seeing Republicans sort of upset with some of the things that are going on in the administration. The spying scandal is a concern to a lot of Republicans who are wary of the power of the government. The high budget deficits, that's very much of concern to them. And the controversies over immigration reform. So while the president may be enjoying a slight uptick here, I think there's some real downside potential for him in 06. And for his party.
Martha.
Particularly with Iraq.
Right.
If things get worse in Iraq, or even don't get better, if the public feels that there's no resolution to this. I mean, his numbers can go up when things seem to be going well at the time of an election in Iraq, but if the casualties increase, and they are so felt at the local level, then you are going to have a continuing dissatisfaction with his leadership.
Also, I'm wondering, right after the start of the new year, obviously, will be the State of the Union address. The president's advisors reportedly have said that just singles and doubles, no home runs in the next State of the Union address, so no major policy changes. Is that a good strategy here? Will that help Republicans going into the midterm elections? Do you think that this is the way to go?
He needs to have some achievements, and he's not going to get Social Security or immigration. So it is best to focus on some small gains.
Okay, briefly then, for 2006, I'm wondering, we only have about a minute and a half left, if I could ask the three of you. Martha, what would you say the president needs to be the major focus for him for 2006, and what will we see?
Focusing on the things that are going right, as John talked about in the economy, showing how the numbers mean something to average Americans, that is important to do. And I think that his recent campaign of explaining his Iraq policy has been helpful, and I think that he should do that on a regular basis.
John, yes, that should be the focus?
Two things the president needs to do in 06. One is sustain public support for his Iraq policy. That's the most important thing on his plate. He has to hope events help him there. And second, do something politically in domestic terms that will allow him to unite his party. His best issue in that regard so far has been tax cuts.
David?
He needs to get out of Iraq, because until the country is out of Iraq, all this other good news is being eclipsed by it.
All right. Well, happy New Year to the three of you.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Deborah.
David Yepsen is political columnist for the Des Moines Register, John Harwood's national political editor for the Wall Street Journal, and Martha Kumar's professor of political science at Towson University in Maryland. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Here and now. As merrymakers ring in the new year, there's potential for cash registers to ring in big profits at restaurants around the country. But as former chef, TV personality, and author Anthony Bourdain told Robin Young this fall, there's also potential for large-scale disaster if the restaurant is not prepared to handle the volume. Anthony's story is part of the collection Don't Try This at Home, Culinary Catastrophes from the World's Greatest Chefs. At the time he spoke with us, he was an assistant chef in a fancy New York restaurant and nightclub.
Maybe it's much too early in the game. But I thought I'd ask you just the same. What are you doing?
I had a really talented chef. As an administrator, he was not so great. And he got us it was a very expensive special menu for New Year's Eve. We were booked solid at a huge nightclub restaurant, and he did not see fit to share the information, such as menu, preparation, recipes, with his staff until the last possible minute. And, of course, it became, for me, the most humiliating and painful mass meltdown I've ever been part of.
It's unbearable to read, frankly, because, you know, you just can't imagine this can happen. First of all, he's late. He doesn't show up. You're all standing there wondering. It's like almost 5 o'clock on New Year's Eve. Half of your colleagues seem to be on drugs waiting to find out what they're supposed to do. When he does show up, as you said, overly ambitious menu. Just if you could just tick off in that kitchen, you know, just a couple of things that were breaking down, I mean, including one of the cooks. What were some of the things that were happening that meant the meal didn't get out?
Well, the timing was bad. I mean, the appetizers coming off of two different stations, you know, the oysters were taking less time, for instance, than the truffle soup, when the truffle soup is supposed to be baked in a crock with a little puff pastry lid stretched over it. And, of course, you know, when it gets hot and you're busy, you know, it's not time to be trying to stretch puff pastry over crockery. The printer shut off for around 25 minutes, which meant that, you know, we were standing there in the kitchen pumping out orders, you know, blissfully unaware of the fact that, you know, 25 minutes of full tilt, you know, orders were being lost in the system. So when they finally started coming in, there was this incredible backlog. When you've had nights like this, and I think most chefs and most cooks at one point in their career somewhere along the line have had, you know, a terrible disaster, it haunts you and molds you for the rest of your life. You know, one of the reasons chefs are so maniacal about their mise en place and planning and preparation is the fear that having lived through something like that once, you know, brings to your every waking moment afterwards.
Wait, has it ever broken down this horribly? I mean, it got to the point where people who were waiting outside for their food, which was not coming, were trying to strangle waiters. Security guards, who are supposed to be bouncers for the party later, were beating up customers who were trying to leave.
I think the most blood-curdling moment for me was when I turned around and saw all of the waiters standing there absolutely silently. When waiters stop complaining and or even asking for food, it's a bad thing. You know, this was a tough, seasoned group of waiters, and here they were literally hiding in the kitchen, afraid to go out on the floor. And, of course, the nightclub, the bouncers, of whom we had, I think, 23, these are people who were used to, you know, dealing with a pretty rough nightclub disco crowd. They really had kind of on-off buttons, you know, off they're not at work and on they're beating on people. So they, you know, they didn't bring the kind of diplomacy one might have hoped for to our somewhat tonier crowd, dinner crowd.
Meanwhile, it is New Year's Eve. They've paid, you know, several hundred dollars for this meal, and it had to be reimbursed.
I think they were perfectly within their rights to walk out without, you know, signing, you know, paying the check. But, you know, security, when they see these people heading for the, you know, just bolting for the door, would would get to try to stop them. They'd, of course, they'd been drinking champagne for 2 hours. They'd get confrontational. And next thing you know, it was a mosh pit.
There are other disasters in the book. I love Daniel Ballou's pea soup for 1,000 that doesn't get refrigerated and ferments so badly that it's bubbling out of canisters. He then has to canvass the whole New York area and buy every pea that he can to remake this. How common is that? You know, chefs running out, something's been destroyed and you've got to replace it. Does that really happen?
It happens all the time. And I think, you know, chefs are very, very resourceful people. It's happened to me. I get a last-minute, you know, party where I need, 600 orders of boned-out poussin, these tiny little birds. I've had to call every poussin farmer in, you know, the East Coast, and they all start, you know, throttling their little birds for me. Most of us are able to reach out at the last moment and fix it. I mean, there's a whole name for it within classic French cooking. It's called System D, and it stands for débrouillard, extricator. It implies a certain sort of sleazy plan B, you know, not as good as plan A, but a way of getting yourself out of a situation or getting through a situation. And I think what one of the notable things about the book is that here you've had all these great chefs overcoming what seems like impossible adversity. And the fact that all of these chefs have that in common points up part of how much a part of the job that is, dealing with the unexpected. Mm. Some of my favorite stories in the book are, you know, Mario Batali, who is still traumatized by this risotto incident that happened years ago when a rather famous British chef throws a hot risotto onto his chest. And Gabrielle Hamilton's story of hiring a blind line cook, I think, is absolutely priceless. It's a very self-deprecating story in which she tries to talk herself into believing that this is going to work out just fine. And, of course, it doesn't. And it's not so much, you know, make fun of the blind guy. It's funny seeing how the kind of torment and the denial that Gabrielle goes through. Some of these stories are legendary. I mean, the Michel Richard story. In fact, he was asked to do his story because people in the industry had been talking about it for 15 years. Let's just say it involves a wedding cake and a couple of dogs. as me or Kimberly Witherspoon, who put together this book, would call around a chef saying, you know, would you like to contribute a story to this book? Again and again, we'd hear, oh, you have to call Michel Richard and ask him, you know, ask him to tell you the wedding cake and doggy story.
I've spent some time in famous kitchens in another life. I was in the Inn at Little Washington when the sous chef there caught on fire. They put him out very politely. That's a very polite kitchen. And at Le Bec Fin in Philadelphia, right before the chef there lost all of his fingers in the Cuisinart.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How often does that happen? I mean, the kitchen can be it seems that the kitchen can be a very hazardous place.
Well, I mean, you're working around open flame, you know, with sharp knives, you know, lots of alcohol, a frequently marginal bunch of people with fiery tempers and unlovely personal habits. You know, it can be, and you're under incredible pressure. Of course, that is it's astonishing how smoothly most kitchens work and that they're able to create magic, every day.
I want a white cloth and linen and a cool pressed napkin, a zip from Delphamen.
Anthony Bourdain's story, New Year's Meltdown, appears in the book Don't Try This at Home, Culinary Catastrophes from the World's Greatest Chefs. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Tara Murphy, Rachel Gottbaum, and Virginia Prescott. Vince Fairchild is our engineer, our web producer is Ken George, and our interns are Jessica Gerard, Lara Farrar, and Angela Kim. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Deborah Becker. Happy New Year, and join us again, Here and Now.
Don't want no chilling dog.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker.